Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray. On this week's show, we're taking a look at how the acceleration in 24-carat bonkers state-sponsored hacking is leading to calls at senior levels of government for some actual norms to be established. We've got Russia hacking the planet with NotPetya, North Korea owning central banks and cryptocurrency exchanges, China owning the sea cleaner supply chain, and, well, it's all getting a bit much. So in this week's feature segment, we're going to zero in on one norm-breaking country, North Korea. We'll hear from John Hultquist of FireEye and Adam Mayers of CrowdStrike on that. And as you'll hear them say, countries like North Korea are pushing the limits of what they can get away with on the internet, and friendlier states are desperately trying to establish what the boundaries for good faith actors should actually be. We'll hear from Australia's cyber ambassador, Tobias Feakin, on that, courtesy of some audio gifted to this podcast by Australian journalist James Riley. That's a fun package, and it's coming up after the news. This week's sponsor interview is with Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences, and boy, oh boy, are they doing well right now. Signal Sciences makes web server security software, and business is just booming for them. Signal Sciences co-founder Zane Lackey will join us this week to talk about a few things: how developer teams are increasingly making their own security decisions and how that's actually a good thing. And we'll also talk about companies that have found themselves operating on multiple cloud platforms, even though they didn't plan for it, even though that was not the plan. It's a pretty wide-ranging chat, that one, actually, and it's coming up later. But first up, of course, it's time for a check of the week's security news headlines with our good friend Adam Boileau. And Adam, the big news doing the rounds at the moment is that AMD processors allegedly have some security problems, which are a bit different to Meltdown Inspector. But nonetheless, 2018 is shaping up as the year of CPU bugs.
Yeah, obviously as CPUs get more and more complicated and the rest of the architecture around them also is super complicated, and as we expect more of them, it's inevitable that people are going to find bugs. In this case, a bunch of researchers from an Israeli crowd called CTS Labs dropped a set of, I think, four different classes of bug against AMD Ryzen and EPYC CPUs. Ryzen's the desktop one, EPYC is the kind of data center one. And yeah, these bugs are not in the branch prediction like they were for Spectre and Meltdown. They're kind of different sorts of things. Full technical details we haven't actually seen yet. Like, they've all got names, of course, and pretty marketing logos and stuff. But we haven't seen a whole load of details. Some of the bugs appear to relate to kind of bypassing the equivalent of secure boot on AMD, like being able to modify the boot up process, backdoor system BIOS, that kind of thing. Some of the other bugs appear to relate to access to the sort of the equivalent of the secure enclave on AMD. I'm not 100% sure what that looks like on that hardware. I'm not super familiar with it. But yeah, it does seem like there's a set of bugs. The thing that has also been in the news about this is that this company disclosed these bugs publicly like a day after telling AMD, compared with the, you know, 6 month lead time that Intel got.
And there's also some very interesting language on the write up, which says, "Oh, look, we may have a conflict of interest," which has led some people to speculate that this team are planning a Muddy Waters style short selling campaign against AMD. Not sure I'm convinced myself at the moment, but it's a possibility.
Well, it certainly is. I mean, you probably could make some money out of that kind of thing. But the company has said that they don't have any position, long or short, in either AMD or Intel. But yeah, it didn't look particularly good in their conditions on their website. So yeah, I mean, I guess more power to you if you do get rich that way.
Now, last week we spoke about this rumor that China was going to ban security researchers from, you know, Chinese companies from attending things like Pwn to Own and dropping bugs. That's now confirmed. We've seen a flurry of coverage relating to this.
Yeah, it sounds like the Chinese, you know, Ministry of State Security has told all of the various companies that had researchers going to things like Pwn to Own, you know, Qihoo and Tencent and Alibaba, have told those companies that their researchers should stay within China and not share the bugs with third-party programs or competitions outside of China. They are apparently still able to report them to the vendor. you know, either for free or for payment, but not through those kind of third-party things. It does seem that the process for reporting those to the vendors does go through the Chinese government, which might give them a little bit of, you know, prior knowledge, perhaps, if they wish to, on those bugs. But yeah, it does seem to be firming up into a picture where, you know, China has realized that these things have a national security value and they want to keep them for themselves.
Meanwhile, China has been caught fiddling with the timestamps on its national vulnerability database, which is interesting to say the least.
Yeah, we covered, I think, like, was it last year sometime, someone had come up with some stats that said the Chinese CNNVD database was, you know, significantly more responsive than MITRE's one in tracking vulnerabilities. And yeah, now that they've been editing the dates on those to kind of cover up which bugs they've known about but then didn't disclose for a
while. Which ones they've been using, in other words.
Well, yeah, and there's a couple of some researchers have been digging through that and have, like, actually pointed some fingers at, you know, some specific bugs where they showed up in the Chinese database, were used against, you know, opponents of the Chinese state, and then got reported and publicly disclosed at some point after that. So yeah, you know, I don't think you'd take a Gruck level analysis to figure out what's going on there.
Speaking of, Gruck did do an analysis, and we're going to link to it in this week's show notes, so you can go check that out. It's a short, sweet hot take, that one, and you know, certainly scans as far as I'm concerned. We've got a great write-up here, courtesy of Andy Greenberg at Wired. He's taken a really decent look at the Hansa dark web bust, and it's, you know, it's the usual Greenberg style dark web takedown write-up, and it's good stuff.
Yeah, it seems like the Dutch police really did have, you know, all their ducks well lined up for this particular takedown. They managed to get a couple of guys involved with running the Hansa dark web market, and then they took it over and ran it, you know, for some months. And they managed to time that just right when the US was about to take down Alphabay. So they got all of the people who were signing up, you know, fleeing the corpse of Alphabay into Hansa, and then they've been modifying the back end of the marketplace to, like, store images before they had their metadata stripped to find geolocation data and images. And apparently they actually RM'd all of the images on the site of people's drugs that they were selling to get people to re-upload them with new metadata. And they caught a bunch of people, and they were, you know, fiddling with the Bitcoin wallet so they could seize it and all sorts of really good stuff. So yeah, it's interesting seeing, you know, what a really competent takedown looks like. And then Andy goes on to speculate about what extent this has, you know, really shaken up the underground, you know, versus just a temporary, you know, moving, you know, the pieces around on the board, as we've seen with some of the previous, you know, more, you know, straightforward takedowns.
Yeah, I mean, way to shatter confidence, right? Which I guess is the whole point of an exercise like
point,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, and they did it well. Meanwhile, a crypto exchange in Hong Kong is offering a $250,000 reward, leading to the arrest of people who've attacked it.
Well, you know, I guess it's a, you know, it's a free market solution to the problem. You know, why not put out a bounty on the people who hacked you and see what shows up? Good luck to them, I suppose. I'm not sure whether this is going to take off as a, you know, standard operating procedure in the rest of the financial markets, but hey, why not?
Yeah, well, let's just see, you know, maybe it's a, you know, I don't know, 250 grand. You could just frame some skiddy, you know, get the money. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
CyberScoop, meanwhile, is reporting that victims of Yahoo's data breach can apparently sue, according to a federal judge, because, you know, when they made a decision to use Yahoo Mail, had they have known that it was so risky using Yahoo, they might have chosen another provider. They want to sue federal government. Federal judge says that's okay, and you know, cue hysterical laughter. But it is kind of interesting, you know. I mean, we see this in the US, is like the civil courts is where they figure out where liability belongs and what that should look like. So it is an interesting development.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's an unreasonable thing to expect that you understand the security properties of the services that you're using. Clearly, that would be a nice thing. I mean, the idea that people would choose or not choose Yahoo Mail on the basis of its security obviously is ridiculous, because that's not what happens. But I think it is a nice idea. And hey, if we can convince cloud vendors that they have to take responsibility for their security, then great.
A bunch of outlets are writing up a bit of malware called Slingshot APT. Is this actually interesting, or is this just doing the rounds because it was a slow news week?
It does have a couple of interesting aspects to it. I mean, it's kind of, you know, your regular, you know, nation state grade malware, has kernel modules, hides itself, does a bunch of, you know, command and control and exfils and, you know, everything you'd ever want from a remote access tool. So, you know, kind of full feature, well written, well tested, which is, I guess, one of the things that points to nation state. The other thing, and the thing that's been capturing people's interest, I think, about this one is one of the deployment mechanisms is quite interesting, which is that people have been compromising Microtik embedded Linux devices, and then through the way that the Windows management software for those devices works, they actually, turns out they pull a DLL off the Microtik router and then run it on the client, which, I mean, obviously is you know, a terrible idea, but whatever. And so it provides a really great path to compromise one of these devices out on the edge of the network somewhere and then immediately pop a shell with your full-featured implant in the middle of the service provider network or, you know, the IT admin people who are looking after it, which, of course, is what we've seen, you know, Five Eyes do with Belgicom, for example, going after the network core. This is just a really, really fast way to go into the network core. And I do note that in the WikiLeaks Vault 7 dump, there was a remote code exec bug against Microtik routers from the CIA. So conclude from that what you will. I mean, it's just coincidence perhaps. But yeah, you've got a remote exploit bug on these devices, and now you've got a way to drop a full-featured implant on the network admins. Now you own the entire service provider. That's pretty cool. So yeah, I you know, that would get you a lot of places.
It is. It's IoT meets APT, if you want to just go acronym crazy. Mm. There you go.
But yeah, so I like it, but I mean, maybe other people think it's boring.
Oh, and Adam, we've got an interesting bit of news here looking at some Citizen Lab research covering Turkey and Egypt. It turns out the governments there have really sort of ramped up the automation when it comes to dropping spyware on user devices.
Well, yeah, I mean, this is what happens, right? I mean, we end up having to Trojan the edge devices when you can't sniff things in the middle of the network. In this particular case, the story goes that Egypt and Turkey have been dropping FinFisher through HTTP intercept in the ISP and then rewriting connections to include, you know, either transparently adding malware to files being downloaded, so executables and installers and things, or redirecting people off onto sites that will then, you know, drop malware on people, which, yeah, it's a pretty good way to, you know, get a lot of people at once, or to do quite specific targeting. We've seen in some cases, you know, groups of users as small as 30 people being targeted. Another angle to the story is that HTTP and kind of content inspection vendor Sandvine, which I gather is, you know, part Canadian, part American owned, have been providing the equipment which does the actual man in the middling. And yeah, if you have access to a cert, then that would be even better. You know, a CA cert for doing that kind of intercept, although in this case, it doesn't appear that there's any suggestion they were doing this for TLS connections, only for ClearText stuff. So, you know, I guess if you're only people through ClearText HTTP, whether you're doing it via intercept or through trojaning, you know, it's kind of, they're both bad.
Oh, Adam, this next story. CyberScoop is reporting some comments by US FBI Director Christopher Wray, where he's talking about this wonderful concept he's discovered called key escrow and how great it is for law enforcement. And it's just like, who is advising this guy? Wrong way, dude. Go back.
Yeah, and there it is. Unfortunately, yes. I mean, one of the criticisms of the FBI is, you know, oh my God, everything's going dark, is they don't have a solution that they think we should do. Key escrow is also not that solution, although, yeah, this particular piece of reporting says that they think it is. He cites an example of this instant messaging, like comm system called Symphony, which provides like perk, it's like group messaging for companies, and it provides a mechanism for individual companies to do key escrow so that they can, in this case, cooperate with the financial regulators. Software is targeted towards banks and, you know, trading houses and that kind of thing. And yeah, a solution for individual businesses where the users are cooperating and using a platform provided by the business that has key escrow maybe is a solution for that particular market segment, but
maybe that's a solution if you've got a, you know, people on a captive platform, but this just won't work for anything wider. I mean, applying these sort of regulations to apps, like you think they're all going to fall into line. This has got to be a platform-based solution. And everybody who's seriously working on policy in the space knows that. So to see the director of the FBI come out and say something so incredibly daft in such a charged area is just bizarre. Who's advising this guy?
Yeah, it does seem kind of counterproductive, right, to bring up arguments that we know are not applicable to the more general problem that they're trying to solve. And yeah, you got to wonder, like, why are we having this conversation, you know, again? I don't know. I guess they're just grasping at straws, right? I mean, they are actually genuinely worried. They have a real problem of stuff going dark, and they're looking for anywhere where this kind of works. But unfortunately, you know, a captive, trusting, playing by the rules user base is not the problem area that they need to address.
Indeed, indeed. Now, look, in a related topic, Motherboard has reported that the feds have busted a CEO of a company selling custom BlackBerries to, you know, like the Sinaloa cartel. And they've charged them as an accessory in cartel activities, which seems to me fair enough. Like, if you're creating a custom-made tool, selling it off to the cartel, advertising it to cartels, guess what? You're kind of operating as an extension of the cartel.
Well, yeah, apparently the Canadian Mounties went undercover and, like, bought phones and asked this company whether or not they could use the, you know, whether it was safe to send messages about delivering MDMA to Montreal, for example. And they said, yeah, totally, no problem. That's what we made them for. So, yeah, didn't really think that one through, I don't think. So, yes, Mr. Phantom Skewer, you're going down, buddy.
And Motherboard also has a piece up there, you know, really talking about the way this stuff is marketed, which, and I remember from the Kazaa trial here in Australia in, when was that? 2004, 2005. I remember covering that for Wired. And the thing that really got them in trouble wasn't so much the technology, it was the way that they'd marketed it. So watch your marketing, people. If you're advocating people do illegal things, it's probably going to cause you problems. Now, the Kaspersky Security Analyst Summit has just taken place, I believe, in Mexico. There's been some interesting talks there, but this one, talking about Olympic Destroyer as a false flag confusion bomb, according to ThreatPost, that doesn't really gel with me, to be honest. I mean, it's my belief that the false flags that were thrown in that malware, I mean, I don't think the people who put them in really expected that it would seriously confuse serious people doing attribution. I think the reason those false flags were put in there was so that people would be discouraged from believing attribution in the future. That is the entire reason for the funny false flags in that campaign, and it seems like people are buying into it hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah, I think you're right. Obviously, we have seen some examples where attribution is pretty concrete, but muddying the waters around all attribution is, you know, in the interests of people who don't want to be attributed to. So, yeah, I think you're right. And yeah, this piece really does play up, and this talk, I guess, really did play up the extent to which the confusion was the thing to take away from this, rather than, well, you know, who's actually got motive, and, like, you know, kind of look through some of the technical attributes and look at the actual, you know, who wants this approach to things.
Well, yeah, and if you're an intelligence agency, you've also got human sources and corroborating intelligence and all of that good stuff. So, yeah, this whole idea that it's going to be this massively confusing thing for geopolitics, I think, is a little bit overcooked. I think that's what the attackers want you to think, but it is, in fact, not the case. And it means next time an intelligence agency comes out with a definitive claim where they might have people on CCTV actually, you know, doing this stuff, a lot of people are going to say, well, look at Olympic Destroyer. How do they know? There are false flags, right? That's the whole point. And people seem to be missing it, which is somewhat annoying. Moving on, and look, this is sort of outside the security beat a little bit, but apparently Slack is developing a bit of a problem with channels devoted to so-called revenge porn or abusive imagery. The reason I mention this at all is because, gee, wouldn't it be great if some sort of large tech company were looking at addressing this problem and coming up with, say, a database of image signatures so that Slack could trivially drop those images from its platform? Gee, wouldn't it be nice if someone was proposing that? Oh, that's right. Facebook already did and they got yelled at for it.
Yeah, I guess you make a good point, right? I mean, it's this is a great example of exactly where that sort of system would be useful. Slack's response overall to this so far has not been particularly aggressive, I guess. Like, they've put out some things saying they're going to start shutting down some of these communities. But, yeah, I mean, like, clearly Slack has got to the point in its size where it does need to have a better way of addressing this. And you have suggested one.
I'm including a link this week to a paper which was published by Concordia University, which looks at browser-based cryptojacking. And I think the TLDR here is that there's basically no money in it, which makes you wonder why people bother.
Yeah. The one bit that I took out of this was someone, they looked at one campaign where someone had jacked like 11,000 domains through like domain squatting, and they had basically 20 seconds average visit time, and they mined like a total of $7 worth of Monero over a 3-month period, which, yeah, like if you just run ads on those, probably would have made more money.
More than $7. It's possible. Oh, it is possible. Let's Encrypt is shipping wildcard certificates now. So, you know, cats are dogs. Hamburgers are eating people.
Yeah, everyone who does any sort of phishing or anything else, rejoice, because now you can have wildcard certs and have less admin setup in setting up your phishing sites. So good stuff. I'm very pleased about that.
I keep waiting for some sort of response. And again, I've said this on the show, like, you know, I don't think it's a great thing that Let's Encrypt is being abused. I don't necessarily blame Let's Encrypt for that. I sort of blame the browsers for marking, you know, domain validated certs as being secure, because that, in my mind, creates confusion out there among normal people who have been told to look for the padlock as a sign of authenticity and trustworthiness for a site. But I'm still waiting for the browser manufacturers to do something about this, because or for some amazing project to kick off at Google dealing with certificate transparency feeds and mining them for, you know, and keeping an eye on them for phishing domains. But it just sort of hasn't happened yet, has it?
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, on the subject of cert transparency, there's a lot of people mining that data set. And that's one of the things I think is going to make a difference here with these wildcard certs, is it takes away the ability to spot, you know, per campaign host names within a phishing domain. Because once you've got a single wildcard cert, you can't then go to the web server and say, I know what the host name it's expecting is, because I haven't seen it now because it's just a wildcard. So I think that's going to make life difficult for the sorts of people who aren't doing that kind of cert transparency analysis.
There he is, Adam Boileau, making good points. Time for this week's comedy bug, Samba.
Ooh, comedy time. Yes, the Samba team have announced two bugs in their set of Windows file serving, you know, Linux Windows file serving software. One of them is boring, denial of service. The other one is hilarious. It turns out that if you were one of the three people on the planet who ran a Samba domain controller, which is actually a thing that it can do these days, they had failed to set the permissions for who could change passwords. So everybody who is authenticated to any account on a Samba domain controller could change anybody else's account, including all the service accounts and machine passwords and whatever else, which is just, I mean, ridiculous and hilarious.
We had a bit of a chat about this before we hit record, because we were sort of debating, like, does this one go in? Because, you know, who runs Samba Active Directory? And it turns out, Adam.
Turns out Amazon does. The Amazon product, which is their simple Active Directory service that they use to auth like Windows machines on AWS, if you buy Windows instances. Turns out that's Samba. So yeah, I'm hoping that Amazon got advanced notice of this bug and patched it all. But yeah, lol. Oh dear.
The internet is pretty much held together with sticky tape, isn't it?
Well,
it really is. And actually, you know, it's a 1-2 punch this week, because we've got another comedy bug courtesy of Cisco.
Yes, Cisco, they're always a reliable provider of comedy bugs. Their Cisco Prime Collaboration Provisioning Service, PCP, terrible acronym, by the way. that's like a thing for setting up authentication in machines that are managed by Prime. Anyway, it turns out hard-coded passwords, so you can just kind of log in and get root. Great, exactly what I want from a centralized provisioning system. So good stuff, Cisco, top work. Let everyone log in with a hard-coded cred again.
Well, they are the world's leading provider of hard-coded credentials in enterprise equipment. It does seem that that is a mantle that they can claim. Adam, that is actually it for the week's news. I do appreciate your time, my friend, and I'll speak to you again next week.
I'll talk to you then, Pat. See you later.
That was Insomnia Security's Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's security news headlines. It is time for our announcements section now, and this week I'm just going to basically repeat last week and encourage all the DFIR types out there to go check out VMware's latest release, version 2.2. They're offering a 30-day free trial, so you can use their service to analyze binaries in their super special VM. So yeah, do go register for your 30-day trial and start throwing some samples at it, see if you like it. The major change to version 2.2 is the UI, so if you haven't looked at it in a while, now is a good time to check it out. You can go to vmray.com/trial to sign up. Okay, it is time for this week's feature segment now, and the topic is about, what we're supposed to do about the modern trend of countries acting like the Soprano family on the internet. Think of the CCleaner supply chain attack, WannaCry, NotPetya, the Swift network attacks against central banks, North Korea taking down cryptocurrency exchanges, even the Saudi Aramco attacks of several years ago, and I guess to an extent Stuxnet. These are things that were borderline unimaginable a decade ago. Now, instead of focusing on Russia or Iran or China for this segment, I thought I'd zero in on a different country, one that's turning to cybercrime to try to bolster its line, like actual profit-motivated cybercrime. And I'm talking, of course, about North Korea. The DPRK is an interesting case study because it's a boundary-pushing pariah state that really just doesn't give two shits about pissing off the international community. There's little recourse you can take against North Korea given the sanctions that they're already under. And their MO is different enough to actually be interesting. Sure, they hack for espionage, but they've also got entire units dedicated towards hacking for profit as well. So our first guest in this segment is Adam Mayers, the VP of Intelligence of CrowdStrike. He gives us some background on North Korea's hacking for profit initiatives and a bit of a wider overview of their activity.
With the North Koreans, they have an office, Office 39, which is specifically tied to revenue and currency generation. And I think that the North Koreans are under unique circumstances given the sanctions on that country and the international pressure. The fact that they were disconnected from the SWIFT banking system is another element that indicates some of that pressure. What's interesting is we've seen in recent months, we've seen that they've taken their focus from targeting international finance to targeting cryptocurrencies, cryptocurrency exchanges, and really anybody involved in cryptocurrency, to include potentially things like ICOs, initial coin offerings.
Yeah, I think that's if I'm North Korea, that strikes me as smart strategy given the popularity of ICOs and cryptocurrencies generally in the south of the in the south half of the country.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. But it also the unique thing about cryptocurrency is that you can use it to get around sanctions. You can use it in countries in which you have operatives that are going to be able to cash that out through exchanges and through other mechanisms. So it's really a digital cash, and they're able to leverage it very much like cold hard cash.
Yeah. So, I mean, you've been observing North Korea for some time. What would you say the trajectory has been in terms of their capability over time? Have they substantially improved, or are they still, because they used to have a bit of a reputation as being, not the most sophisticated actor out there. That seems to be changing, but I want to hear from someone who actually pays close attention.
Yeah, I think that, we track a number of different actors out of North Korea. So it's not just one set. We track a group that we call Silent Kalima. Silent Kalima has been involved in espionage, destructive attacks, and to a lesser degree, monetization. We have Stardust Kalima, which has been widely focused on revenue and currency generation. They've been tied to the SWIFT attacks, to things like WannaCry and some of the cryptocurrency targeting. We've got a group that we track is Ricochet Kalima, which has been focused primarily on espionage activity, kind of smash and grab type espionage activity. We've also seen them involved with deploying Android tools, Android implants. And then the last group is Labyrinth Kalima, again, also very much focused on espionage and primarily targeting South Korea.
So, but what about the actual trajectory in terms of skills and tooling? Have you actually been able to observe a change in those groups? Are they getting better? Are they clearly getting better training, or is it just they're just doing whatever works?
I think that they've developed operational discipline and maturity. I think the tools have not changed vastly. We've seen new tools coming into play that have been home built, and it seems that all of the different groups have a shared, some shared access to the tools that they develop and build. So we see a lot of things, a couple of days after WannaCry, people had identified code overlap between WannaCry and some of the SWIFT attack stuff. And so that very much, I think, ties back to the fact that there was shared code and that there was things that one group was using in their currency generation for using ransomware, and another element was used for targeting the SWIFT and the financial system. So I think that they have been continuing to develop the tools. And, an interesting and really important thing to keep in mind is that the tool itself is not the only mark of sophistication or competence.
Indeed, indeed, Adam. We agree here at Risky Business that operational sophistication trumps technical sophistication every day of the week. Now, something that makes the North Korea discussion interesting and relevant to a broader discussion around state-sponsored activity is all these threat actors are watching and learning from each other. Adam Mayers used to work at the US State Department, and our next guest, FireEye's Director of Intelligence, John Hultquist, was actually his colleague there, which is a fun coincidence. He says there's nothing new about countries watching each other push the limits to better understand what they might get away with, and that's a trend that's been in place for years. It's only now that things have gotten truly, truly wild. Here's John Hultquist.
I think it's been going on for years. I think every one of these, all of these players, or at least the major players, have been learning from each other. I think the experience that we've had with, at least the West has had with China, which has changed somewhat recently for the West, the length of time it took to really curtail that effort. I think even the Stuxnet incident may have caused responses that may have cued other actors. Like the Iranians may have responded to Stuxnet with Operation Ababil, which was a major DDoS attack against the financial sector. That may have cued others' activity that it's time that they can get away with more and push the red lines. And I will tell you, I've been doing this for 10 years, and almost every red line I have thought that wouldn't be crossed has been crossed.
Well, the Swift attacks are a great example of that, and more recently, cryptocurrency exchanges.
Absolutely. So we didn't anticipate that North Korea would turn to straight criminality, and they have taken to it like a fish to water. They've leveraged these capabilities that have been used for a long time, pretty fairly quietly, for espionage, for this whole new mission. And we think that incident could teach others that you can get away with that sort of thing.
So where does this leave us? Well, I stumbled across an interesting interview a friend of mine did in Jakarta with Australia's cyber ambassador, Tobias Feakin. The journalist is James Riley, and he gave me permission to use this recording. The audio is not fantastic, sorry about that. But I was struck by how much of an active discussion this whole idea of establishing norms actually is in diplomatic circles. I mean, I guess it's what we've hoped for, but it's nice to know that it's actually what's happening. To make a long story short, governments are actually trying to do something about this trend. And it's top of mind. Here's Tobias Feakin, Australia's cyber ambassador.
I think probably the biggest problem we have in the international system now is perhaps not so much the division of language, but if you like, the way in which different countries are perceiving what is or isn't okay in terms of behaviour online. Be it the election interference, be it some of the pushing of boundaries in terms of, some of the cyber activity we see going on in places like Ukraine, and further afield, some of the activities you're seeing around WannaCry, the blurring of state and non-state activities, it's reached a concerning level now, whereby we as a government think that's something we have to be contributing in a positive way to try and help set some of those parameters. Many nations that I now speak to know that we have an environment in cyberspace, which is, of course, we're all after the wonderful opportunities that it provides, but we also do see now that there's boundary pushing, which we need to think seriously, okay, well, how do we draw up some kind of limitations on what's going on? Because what we also see in the online environment is that a particular state or entity will push the boundaries of what's acceptable, and then others might copy that, and often do. And that is deeply problematic, because we are dealing with an evolving international relations issue, legal issue, normative issue. So we're trying to get a grasp on where those limitations might lie. We as a country now, and one of the things we've done which others haven't, is we've actually now put into policy, if you like, the legal basis on which we would act in cyberspace, and also the kinds of normative principles that we adhere to in cyberspace as well. And we've agreed that we will publish regular updates on our approach to international law, to just show that we're willing to set trends rather than just follow others in terms of how we perceive.
So effectively, you're saying this is the kinds of behaviour that is acceptable to us, And this is the kind of response that we would. I mean, I think the Prime Minister talked about an offensive capability, which he generally doesn't do, or governments generally don't do, in that 2016 launch. So that's effectively what you've done.
Yeah, and we actually expanded somewhat on the language that he used because we think that's an important discussion to be having. You know, if you think of any particular capability area, be it, I don't know, let's say frigates or something, you know, we discuss those quite openly, wouldn't we? We'd talk about the exact, you know, exactly what they can or can't do because that's part of what you hold back in the locker.
Yeah.
But when you're dealing with offensive capabilities and in, you know, cyber capabilities, we feel as a country it's important to be discussing those so that you can have a rational discussion on the international stage, because what we do have are a range of states that are developing capabilities but unwilling to recognize or acknowledge they have them or talk about them.
Yeah.
And that's not a healthy place to be, especially if you see states pushing those boundaries. Because the more of a transparent discussion you can have around things that are being developed, the more likely we are to get into a state where, okay, they're part of a toolkit, but there are parameters on how they can or can't be used.
Sure. Last question. So, like, you've done a year. So what's happening in the coming year? What are expectations? What's your focus?
Okay. So this may sound a bit philosophical and esoteric. It's trying to answer that question of what next in the international state discussion. We seem to have reached a moment where there's a lot of peeling off of positions and quite polar opposite opinions on what we do in terms of drawing up those limitations. Building on the strategy, I'm now trying to work out what is the positive narrative that we as Australia bring to the table, using that trusted brand that we have, using the fact that we're not a superpower, so we can speak with a very different voice.
Yeah.
And adding like something different to the discussion and helping be one of those countries that unlock the door to some solutions. Because there's a danger if we don't do that off the back of the momentum we have, the political support, the business support, then we lose our way globally. And that's not, I'm not trying to, you know, be too profound, but it's true. We are in a kind of genuine moment in time right now. So we're thinking about that. And to be frank, delivering on the strategy that we've developed and making sure, you know, that we're delivering on all the actions that we promised, and making sure that they're done. Well, that's what I've been brought in to do. I've got to make sure that's there.
All right. Well, we wish you all the best with it.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
That was Australia's Cyber Ambassador, Tobias Feakin, there being interviewed by James Riley of Innovation Oz. Thanks to JR for letting me use that audio. And there you have it. This segment was a bit of a mishmash, this feature, a collage, if you will. But the TLDR is establishing these norms is now something governments are actively working on, and the acceleration in rogue behavior is driving those initiatives. So fun times ahead, and you know, probably a topic we're going to pick up again over this year. Anyway, on to this week's sponsor interview now with Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences. Zane is a co-founder, and lucky for him, because business is going absolutely berserk. Signal Sciences makes web server security software. You can think of it as like a RASP and WAF solution, if you like. And yeah, their tools were designed and developed by people who actually worked in security and on development teams. So even though Signal Sciences has been around for years and doing, you know, really well for a startup, business basically went into hyperdrive late last year when their software was put up against the competition in some bake-offs. And they've done very well out of them, and now the demand is just out of control. So yay and well done to the team at Signal Sciences. Now, Zane wanted to join me today to talk about a trend he's seeing. He says development teams are increasingly taking ownership of security decisions themselves. Now, that's the type of thinking that used to make hardened InfoSec pros shudder. But Zane says in 2018, this can often be a good thing. A lot of these developer teams now actually understand security and risk, and InfoSec teams in many organizations are serving more in an advisory capacity rather than being the overseers. Here's what Zane Lackey had to say.
I think there's a few forces at work there that are really interesting. And it's kind of early days for all of that, but it's being done out of necessity, which is that for some organizations, you know, they're getting the real push to move to cloud, move to DevOps. That's coming from the CIO or the CTO or even the board to move much quicker on that side. And so for some organizations, they're really looking at security through the lens of, hey, what can we care about security. What can we bring in that's actually going to work for that newer model? Sometimes that's with, you know, a lot of consultation with the security team, and the security team can say, hey, here's what we're seeing and here's what we'd recommend. Other times where it's, you know, very legacy security teams that are trying to fight the shift to cloud, they unfortunately, they basically get routed around, where the rest of the business says, okay, well, if you can't keep up with this shift, we're going to go make the security decisions ourselves. And when you can kind of come back to the table and make real recommendations other than just saying don't go to cloud because we're mandated that we have to go to cloud, then we can really re-engage. And I think at the same time, there's this big shift that's going on of kind of this, the organization of security groups themselves, where it was historically, you know, security has always been the group that, for the most part, owned the risk for the business and really functioned as this kind of, even though it was still inside the company, it was a outsourced group that did kind of all of the work in that space. It's really shifting to this kind of central services group that advises the rest of the business on risk and ideally provides tooling and best practices and policies and, you know, here's how to actually enable the shift to DevOps, here's how to enable a shift to cloud, but here's how to enable those business initiatives. But really allows the individual business units to kind of own the risk themselves, and the security team becomes kind of advisory in that.
Yeah, nature. So it's like, we'll sign off on it, please don't f it up. Do what you're going to do, right? Like, if you do what you say you're going to do, is what you're saying you're going to do, it's fine, we'll sign off, don't f it up.
Yeah, that, or even sometimes, hey, here's, we're not going to sign off on it, here's what you're going to sign off on for the risk. Do you want to own this risk? Because here's the ways you could mitigate it, and we probably want to meet somewhere in the middle about that.
Yeah, look, that makes sense. And it also makes sense that what you're describing, it's like there's a good reason this is happening in the case of, you know, teams taking good advice and actually trying to structure stuff that's just good engineering. And so much of security is just good engineering and you know, good planning and good management. And then there's the bad reason, which is, well, these guys are really, well, these people are really, you know, uncooperative in the security group, so we'll just go around them. You know, it's pretty clear to see which is the organization you want to be in, right?
Exactly. You know, everybody loses when it's the organization where they just get kind of routed around like that. And I think it's kind of happened to enough organizations now that everyone's recognizing that that's a real lose-lose threat to everybody. And so security teams are really trying to, you know, shift to this kind of enablement philosophy.
But I mean, just to be fair, this is a conversation we've been having for about 15 years in the InfoSec discipline of security as an enabler, you know, like, yeah. And it's great to hear, you know, some talk about it maybe actually happening, but, you know, forgive me for being a little bit, you know, skeptical.
Oh, you and me both, man. You and me both. I think what's actually changed a little bit there is that the technology and the business process around going from waterfall and data center to cloud and DevOps or Agile, it's kind of forced everyone's hand, right? It's one thing to say security is an enabler when we were all still moving very slowly in data centers and waterfall and all of that. But I think it's kind of these external pressures that actually make change happen.
Yeah. No, I mean, I totally agree with that. And I think DevOps too is something that if you're gonna screw it up, it's pretty fatal, right? So people tend to put a little more thought into it, depending on the shop.
Yeah.
I'll give you that. Now, another thing that you mentioned to me is that you're seeing organizations realize that even though it might not have been the plan, they are all of a sudden, you know, multi-cloud customers, right? They're not just sticking on one platform as might have been their original plan. There's been acquisitions, there's been, you know, new projects that just couldn't be fulfilled on one platform or the other. So they're having to manage these, you know, multiple cloud deployments. Is that much of a challenge though? I mean, I would have thought the cloud is the cloud is the cloud, or is it really, really nuanced and different between different providers?
Yeah, I think it just kind of iterates our thinking about cloud, right? In the sense that, and this is a fairly new phenomenon, I'd say. This has cropped up more in conversations that I've had in the last 6 to 8 months. But I've had enough conversations with CTOs and CISOs around this that it kind of surprised them that they're like, look, we're really planning to go all in on one cloud provider. We're going to use as many services that provider offers as possible, and really go all in. And then what they see is, oh, the business actually made an acquisition that's all in on a different cloud provider. Or they recognize that, okay, well, you know, a different public cloud provider has actually matured enough that we're going to put some applications over there. Or, you know, there's this one team that really needs specialized capabilities around X, and there's only one cloud provider that really does it.
Well, and it's the specialized capabilities that are what get you in trouble, right? That seems to be where the risk is in the case of like AWS exactly. And Lambda and all of this horror show stuff that no one really quite understands how it works.
Yeah, so I think it changes things both from a just general engineering side and then especially from a security side, where you recognize from an engineering side, okay, maybe we don't want to go all in on the services of a particular cloud provider. We just want to have a think about it and use the ones that are really strategic. But from a security side, you start to think, okay, well, if I was going to use the security services of that one cloud provider, what happens when we make an acquisition in 6 months? That's all in on a different cloud provider, how am I going to get some uniform coverage across those? It's a tough role, right? When you're a CISO in a role where your organization is going cloud, and then suddenly you have to start to think about it from a multi-cloud side of things, you start to think about, okay, how do I iterate my strategy here to make sure that when I get coverage over whatever's moving to the cloud, I can get kind of uniform coverage over regardless of what the cloud provider is.
It's funny, right? Because it's just making me remember an interview I did years ago. It's one of my favorites actually of all time, which was the last sponsored interview I did with Brad Arkin. Because what happened is they got owned, like, you know, the data breach got revealed sometime after that and they had to shut down all PR. But I think it was the last sponsored interview that Adobe did on Risky Business, where Brad Arkin, who was the CISO, was talking about exactly this problem, because I think at various periods, Adobe was acquiring something like two companies a month, right? And they had completely different stacks. And he said some of them, you'd go in, you'd look at how they'd been running things, and no one's done due diligence on their security, right? You look at it and you're just like, my God, how do you live? How do you sleep? What are you doing? But his solution to that was to basically come up with like five, to try to consolidate all of these acquisitions and these, you know, million gajillion services, to try to consolidate them into one of like five company mandated approaches. I mean, that's, when you're a very large company like Adobe, that might make sense, but perhaps less so for a smaller company that might be across three or four cloud providers, right?
Yeah, I think there's a there's that moment in every security person's life, whether they're a security analyst up to a CISO, that where they go through their first acquisition and bringing that on board. I will say, to put it mildly, it changes your thinking a bit.
Yeah. So what is the solid recommendation then? I guess it's like, where do you even start to try to make that uniform? If the starting assumption is that you're going to use many different providers, what do you do to try to actually get some sort of uniform approach to, say, monitoring and, you know, security generally across your infrastructure?
Yeah, I don't think this is an area where you make radical changes and everything shifts out from under you. I think what I'm really seeing is, and through my own experience, really is you make sure flexibility is a requirement as you're thinking about this. So you don't want to make, whether it's a technology choice or a best practice or a policy or anything like that, you don't want to make something that really is reliant on capabilities of only one provider. Even if that's a data center provider, let alone a cloud provider, you really want to be thinking about how can I get coverage over whatever underlying infrastructure or application platform we're going to have, whether that's coverage of, you know, defending applications or pulling logs off of those boxes for your incident response and security operations efforts or anything like that. You really just think about flexibility as a key requirement in the choices that you're making there.
Now, you know, often, you know, running a security podcast, we're talking about stuff like, you know, amazingly well-run networks with 2FA everywhere. We're sort of talking about the typical network of, you know, the year 2030, not the typical network of now. So normally we're talking about what's ahead when the market is quite behind. But then there's the other part of the market that is really, really behind. And something interesting that you say is that 2017 was the year that a lot of organizations actually finally realized that they had to go to the cloud, which seems quite late to me, to be honest.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, I think it's very easy in security to kind of end up in a bubble and a bit of an echo chamber there. We're thinking that either people are further ahead than they are, or we're all kind of talking about the next greatest technology. And as you really get out there and speak with a bunch of organizations that are not at that leading edge, you recognize how much of a bubble a lot of us end up actually being in. And so 2017 was interesting for me because I'm really fortunate now that I get to speak to a real breadth of different organizations.
It really changes your mind, right? Because you're a former pen tester turned in-house security at a Silicon Valley darling. You're at Etsy, right? So it's all, everything's wonderful and DevOps and everything's well managed, right? And I've known a few people in this situation where they go off and they work in some other aspect of InfoSec and they wind up going in and seeing what a typical enterprise looks like. And these are the enterprises that don't even hire pen testers. And it's illuminating.
That is a very good word choice right there. It is absolutely illuminating. absolutely. So yeah, I think 2017 was interesting for me in that regard, in that in previous years, I still saw folks that, even the ones that are kind of consciously the later adopters, right? They'll be the first ones to tell you. They're like, look, we wait for everybody else to go first, establish the best practices, and then we actually kind of make those changes.
Depending on your type of business, I mean, that can make sense, right? There's some,
yeah.
I can think of some sort of second tier financial services companies like pension funds or whatever, where their IT budget is a fixed amount of what's under management, right? And it's a small number, and the way that they compete is by compressing costs wherever they can. And they're not really expected to be innovative. They're expected to sit there and conservatively invest money. So that makes sense for them, right?
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing, is just because they're later adopters doesn't mean that's necessarily by accident, right? And a lot of times it's actually a strategic choice.
Yeah.
And so 2017 was really interesting in that for a lot of that group I got to speak with, they really recognized, okay, cloud, now is kind of our time to go to cloud. And so even though it feels like, you know, when you talk with a bunch of forward-leaning companies, it's like, you know, well, we've been in the cloud for so long that I barely remember the time before it. But I think for the majority of enterprises, for certainly a large chunk of enterprises, they're at the start of that adoption curve, actually, not at the tail end of it.
All right, Zane Lackey, thanks a lot for joining us to have a bit of a, you know, general roundup, I guess, of what's going on out there in the enterprise, in the enterprise DevOps world. It's been very interesting, and congratulations on all of your recent success, and I look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Hey, likewise. Thanks for having me, and congrats on the family, man. So excited for you.
That was Zane Lackey of Signal Sciences there with this week's sponsor interview. Big thanks to him for that. And that is it for this week's show. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.